Welcome to Libertarians Working for You with host Arvind Vohra. Our program explains how to solve the most critical problems we face in America today: unemployment, debt, healthcare affordability, high taxes, loss of personal freedoms, loss of privacy, threats of war, and more. Now, here is your host, Arvind Vohra.
Welcome back to Libertarians Working for You. I'm your host, Arvind Vohra. Today we're going to talk about the way in which liberty makes us better. See, too often people suggest that the goal of the Libertarian Party, the goal of the Libertarian movement, is to enable every kind of degeneracy. They say the goal of the Libertarian Party is to make it easier for people to get high all the time. That's all we want to do. To make it easier to live a licentious and degenerate lifestyle. But the thing is, that's actually the opposite of the truth. If you look at libertarianism purely as a political philosophy, politically speaking, based on the laws that the Libertarian Party believes in, the laws that the libertarian movement believes in, yes, technically, the libertarian vision allows people to smoke as much marijuana, do as much heroin, have as many sexual partners, have as many kids as they like. But the thing that people often forget is that libertarianism doesn't show up all by itself. No, no, no. Libertarian political philosophy has a friend that it shows up with. And that friend is a lot less forgiving. Who is that friend? That friend's the free market. If you see libertarianism right next to it, you got free market capitalism. Libertarianism lets you do whatever you want. That's your choice. If you think this is a good idea, go ahead and do it. But free market capitalism is not quite as nice. Free market capitalism holds you accountable in that constant, precise, searching, endless way that only free market capitalism can. Give you an example. Suppose that you want to do a whole pile of marijuana. I'd smoke marijuana all day long, every day, all day, do nothing else. Libertarianism will not pass a law against it. You can do it. And if for whatever reason your mindset combined with all that marijuana somehow makes you very productive, very artistic, very skilled at building things, who knows? A great writer, if somehow that happens, then the free market will reward you. But if it doesn't, then the free market will punish you. That's the thing. The free market will hold you accountable for every single one of your decisions. The free market is merciless. A company that has a not as good logo is not going to succeed as well as a company with a better logo. The free market doesn't like the color you paint the walls of your business. It's going to be merciless with you. And if you go out of your way to be self-destructive, you develop a drug habit or become addicted to alcohol or become addicted to drugs, the free market will hold you accountable for that decision. If you choose to do that, then that's on you. You now have the responsibility. The free market is not going to pay for your healthcare. The free market's not going to pay for your food. If the only thing that you are able to do is to get high all the time, then the free market will either let you starve or let you beg. I mean, that's basically it. The free market actually pushes us to higher levels of excellence than anything. If the free market, it doesn't just say, listen, you're going to get punished if you're high all the time. Being not high is not enough. To succeed in the free market, you have to do a lot of things. You have to be excellent. You have to be timely. You have to listen to customers. You have to listen to your bosses. You have to constantly try to push yourself to a higher and higher level. Great innovators have always said that you need to constantly innovate and change. Constantly innovate and change. That's what the free market says. The free market says that if you refuse to innovate, if you refuse to adapt to the times, it's going to punish you for that. In other words, it will punish you for not being excellent enough. Forget about being a degenerate. I mean, forget that. If you're going to be degenerate, then the free market is, I mean, if you're going to, the free market will be far colder than the state will be. You know, even when you get in prison and put into a rape cage, yeah, that's pretty bad, but you do get fed. I mean, the free market will let you starve to death. That's why it works. The free market doesn't need to declare a war on drugs. The free market has a permanent war on anything that's not as good. If the free market, if your skill set isn't adapting to the times, if your discipline isn't adapting to the times, if you're insisting on doing stupid stuff, then yes, the free market is going to be so much more merciless than the state. If we want to end drug use, I don't think we need to have a war on drugs. I don't think we need to do anything at all. I think we just need to say that if you're high all the time, well, then that's, you know, your problem. You're going to pay the consequences. And if you're high in a way that doesn't inhibit your productivity, then who's to tell you not to? If it's not hurting anybody, if you're not hurting anybody, if you're productive, what difference? Who else's business is it besides yours? One of the really interesting areas that people have been talking about lately, I saw so many articles this weekend, so many people have sent me messages asking about it, is what happens to a culture when the free market is artificially shut down? And many people, interestingly, over the last week, have been sending me links to show what's happening in a lot of these red pill type sites. And if you don't know what that is, red pill is basically a group of people that dedicate pretty much a good portion of their time to various forms of psychological manipulation for the purpose of getting sex. That's basically what it does. And people have asked, is this what libertarians believe in? And let me say this. Libertarians believe that that is a direct consequence of socialist, welfarist policies. Throughout human history, men, or forget human history, throughout animal history, males have competed for females, for all animals, for all species of animals. That they've done whatever they can to have that reproductive or sexual advantage. And for most of human history, what did men do in that circumstance? What was the number one thing that they realized? They realized that the number one thing that a man could do was to be a provider. And so men learned skills that let them be providers. And you know what happened? Those are good skills. Whether you're learning to build a building, build a computer, become a programmer, become a doctor, become a lawyer, or within your field to constantly improve, that benefits all of us. That benefits society. That's a good thing. That is a good thing for men to do. It's a good thing for women to do. It's a good thing for anybody to do. But today, that providership is of lower priority. And many people have argued that that's because women work nowadays, and I strongly disagree. I don't think that might be some small contributing factor, maybe. But I just simply do not think that this is caused by the fact that women work. I think it's caused by the fact that anybody who is able to be a provider is by force required to be a provider for anybody with kids. Think about this. Somebody doesn't need to be a biological father of a child to be required to pay for that child, or a biological mother of a child to be required to pay for that child. Everybody is by force required to pay very astronomical fees for the upbringing of any child, theirs or otherwise. So if somebody is making a decision about what to do for that reproductive and sexual advantage, which has driven the entire animal kingdom for millions of years, if they're going to be making that decision, they're going to have to decide, should they focus on higher productivity, Or should they focus on creating the illusion of being thrilling? Or psychological manipulation? Or what realistically you'd have to call psychological abuse? And the young men who are making those decisions right now are increasingly coming down on the second side. And that's not a good thing at all. That's not good for society. It's not good for sexual relationships. It's not good for human relationships. It's not good for economic productivity. It's not good for anybody for people to be taking that time and energy that they could be using to build flying cars and instead squander that time and energy on finding ways to engage in various types of manipulation. Now, in the past, if your only skill was manipulation, then, you know, realistically, your kids are going to starve to death. But today, having manipulation as your only skill, it's actually not so bad. Kids, somebody else will pay for your kids' food and clothing. Just because you yourself don't have any useful skills doesn't mean nobody else does. Other people pay for your kids' food and clothing, health care and Medicare, and maybe even your own. That's where we are right now. The red pill is not a symptom of the growth of libertarianism. It is a symptom of the growth of socialism. And in a couple of minutes, we're going to talk about how we can turn that around. What happens if we shut down that socialism? What happens to human relationships if developing skills other than psychological manipulation can significantly increase advantage? Libertarianism is not just an avenue to cultural degeneracy. It is not. Because the free market is far more merciless with cultural degeneracy than the state could ever be. We're going to talk about that a little bit more after this break. Right now, you're listening to Libertarians Working for You. I'm your host, Arvind Vohra. We'll be right back.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com.
Have you found the beauty inside of you? Join Bonnie Bonadeo each week for Beauty Inside and Out. We'll explain how beauty plays a part in everybody's lives. Our guests are makeup artists, hairdressers, and doctors. But we'll also feature holistic and wellness specialists and spiritual advisors. You can find that beauty inside and express it to its fullest on the outside. Tune in to Beauty Inside and Out every Thursday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Life is complicated, and sometimes we all need a little help, but don't have the time for a full hour-long session or don't know who to turn to. That's where BetterHelp comes into play. With BetterHelp, I can get matched with one of over 2,500 licensed and approved counselors and therapists and get help anytime, anywhere, totally private. For a flat weekly fee starting at $35, I can connect with my counselor via text, chat, video conference, or phone, which is great for me because I'm always on the go. And I can go back to previous sessions whenever I want through my secure account from anywhere in the world. It's a great feeling to know that help is there, affordable, private, and convenient to my schedule. We all can use a little help. Visit betterhelp.com/VA health and register for free. You can try it for 7 days without being charged on your credit card and get matched with a licensed counselor usually within 24 hours. Get BetterHelp today at betterhelp.com/VA health.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This is Libertarians Working for You. If you wish to connect with our show, please call 1-866-472-5788. That number again is 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to comments@lp.org. Here again is Arvind Vohra.
Welcome back to Libertarians Working for You. A few years ago, a very close friend of mine went to Cuba. And what she told me was fascinating, that essentially Cuba had two economies. Everybody had their official job, where it was a job in a communist dictatorship. the work was silly, the pay was low. And then they would have their black market job. And their black market jobs usually revolved around tourism, you know, providing tours or art or entertainment or whatever to people from other countries, people who actually had some money, because of the total lack of any fruits of anybody's labor in Cuba, there just weren't that many fruits of their labor to go around. None of the labor was very fruitful. And that creation of a secondary economy was good for the people, but it wasn't a great situation. Imagine if all those people who were putting so much time and thought and effort into tourism would put that same level of time and thought and effort into all the other needs that the Cuban people have. Clearly they're not. I mean, Cuba's economy is a laughingstock. The only thing that they've produced of consequence that I could think of is maybe cigars, and you can run an entire economy on cigars. Now, what we have right now going on a lot of the red pill type sites is something very similar. The real economy has become, in this important way to many young men and women, especially many young men, has become meaningless. And so instead of putting their energy into the economy of building things, creating services, doing stuff that's useful for society, useful for other people, useful for their customers, even useful for themselves, they're putting their energy into this black market. And instead of making money in the black market, the goal is they're building the skills that'll give them the sexual advantage. Now, these skills don't help, you know, their closest thing to a customer, the people that they're manipulating, and it doesn't help them either, because all that time they could be putting into becoming more productive, more useful, just into becoming better, they're putting that effort into becoming worse. That's what we have today. And the cure to that, in my view, is very, very simple. It's to end socialism completely in America, to end socialized education, to end socialized medicine, to end socialized everything, end socialized roads, to make it so that everything you do, everything you use, you pay for. Everything you don't use, you don't pay for. Because if people are allowed to view their work as sacred, and it is, because you're putting yourself into a thing, you're putting your soul into a thing, that's what it means to do, to be productive, to do work. When you look at just a hunk of wood that one day becomes a very beautiful finished table or shelf or chair, what was added to the wood to turn it into that? What was added into it? Labor, soul, effort, energy, intellect, ability, all of that. That's something sacred. That's something magical. That's something that only humans do. We take something that's kind of not really significant and transform it into something amazing. You look at an iPad, what is it? Some plastic? Some glass? A little bit of metal? And it's transformed into this thing that's like Aladdin's lamp. That's sacred. That's divine. And this is me speaking, who's not even religious. Even I can see the divinity in that. And that needs to be treated accordingly. Because if it's not treated accordingly, then we end up with this underside. If we don't value that, if we don't value a person's right to create and to control the fruits of their labor, then that person is not going to value that either. They will value something else higher. They will value something else that is less good higher, because they've been forced to devalue and disrespect the fruits of their labor. Why disrespect? Because we've made a situation where the government can take it and act like it's not a big deal. It's not, oh my God, I'm so sorry that we have to do this. It's not, I recognize that this is your sacred fruits of the labor, but for the absolute survival, we need to take this small amount so that we're not obliterated by an invading army. No, no, no. We're going to take it. It's our money more than yours. You didn't build it. We're going to take it. We're going to use it on something stupid, and we'll find something even stupider. And when you see so many young men who are not taking that part, not treating that part with the sacredness it deserves, it's not because they don't think it's sacred. It's because the government acts like it's not sacred. It does not let them treat it as sacred. If something is sacred to you and someone tries to take it from you by force, you kill them or die trying. Realistically, that's what you do. If somebody tries to take something sacred from you by force, that is what you do. That is natural self-defense. But that's not what we're allowed to do. There's so much overwhelming force on the other side. We're not allowed to do that. We are not allowed to treat our work sacredly. So what do people do instead? Put their effort into backwards and damaging pursuits, which is all that's left to them once the actual sacredness has been stripped away. I want to answer some of the questions. We have a bunch of questions coming in from listeners. The first, I'm going to do these in just some kind of rough approximate order. Why won't the LP denounce the socialist infiltrators? That's an interesting question. There are people who are calling themselves libertarian socialists. And to me, if you want to be collectivist and not use any force, go ahead and do it. I don't care. If you want to use one drop of government force to enforce your socialism, then I have a problem with it. So, for example, let's say you have a socialist view that, you know, my car is also your car. Well, you can have that view. But I might pay for an insurance system that will stop you from doing that. That's a private sector insurance thing that I pay for, not a state thing. I might develop my personal skills of self-defense or armed self-defense and stop you from doing that. We recognize that taxation is theft, but it's not the only form of theft. If you take something that's not yours, if you take something that someone else has worked for, or built, or whatever, that's not yours. So if somebody says, in a libertarian society, can I buy some land and set up a collective? Yeah, sure, why not? In a libertarian society, can I engage in that true state-based socialism? No. And I think that we've been very clear in our platform, in our public statements, including this public statement, that there is no room for state socialism in the libertarian movement. There is none. There is none at all. Brent asks, we are all supposed to bake the cake and taxation is only kind of theft now. I just don't think that Brent is right about that. Sorry, Brent. I think that taxation is absolutely theft. I think that there are people who like to say it because it sounds cool and aren't willing to actually back it up. When people say, well, if you think taxation is theft or public school is theft, there are a lot of people who will be like, well, no, not public school. Those aren't libertarians. Those are just people who want to be trendy. But there are many, many more people that when you say, so are public schools theft, they'll say, yes, absolutely, public schools are theft. Anything funded by taxation is theft. In terms of baking the cake, there is no question in the libertarian movement, libertarian party platform, however you want to look at it, that no business should be forced to serve anybody that they don't want to. That said, remember what I said about the free market in the first part of the show? Politically, you're allowed to reject any customer you want, according to libertarian philosophy. But guess what? The libertarian philosophy's best friend, the free market, it's right there. And if you're saying, listen, our restaurant doesn't serve gay people, fine, you lose a few gay clients, and you're probably going to lose a lot of straight clients too. If there was a restaurant that didn't serve gay people, I wouldn't go. I'm not gay, but I still wouldn't go. If somebody that I knew went, I would make fun of them viciously. That's a fact. I would mock them. I would publicly shame them. I would not use force. I might post on Facebook. So, yeah, you have the right. You have the right to refuse to serve anybody you don't want to serve, but you also have to deal with the consequences. And in the modern era, those consequences may well be that you'll go out of business. And if you're willing to take a stand and put your business on the line, you know, I guess that's your right. I don't think it's smart business, but so I don't think that the idea that the libertarian that there's any belief that the libertarian philosophy allows allows restrictions on what businesses can do. However, they do realize that the free market's right there, right next to libertarian political philosophy, to make sure that you are held accountable for your decisions, not legally, economically. Michael asks, why do so many libertarians claim that libertarians do not recognize borders when the platform clearly recognizes borders? I don't think that the libertarian philosophy is that borders simply don't exist, although there are many libertarians that believe that. I think the libertarian philosophy is saying that they just shouldn't really make any difference. That if you are going to cross a border, no one should be able to stop you from doing so. It's basically about immigration into the United States. That's all it's talking about. It's not some theoretical thing of this one country. We're saying, let's talk about what the question is. Should people be allowed to immigrate into the United States? And the libertarian answer is very simple. Nick Starwark has said it. I've said it on many different media appearances, and I'm saying it right now, which is, if somebody poses no immediate threat, they should be allowed in. Yeah, somebody has 50 pounds of plutonium strapped to them, we should probably not. But if there's any normal situation, they should be let in. However, this is a big however, they shouldn't be getting any welfare. No public schools, no food stamps, none of that. No one should. It doesn't matter where you were born. Even if your ancestors came over in the Mayflower, that does not give you the right to force somebody else to pay for your stuff. That is a fundamental libertarian view. Let's take a look at one more question before this break. Is there any part of libertarian philosophy that cannot be practically implemented in a political party structure? Fabio asked this. I can't think of any off the top of my head. I think pretty much any part of libertarian philosophy can be implemented politically. It's just simply a matter of getting rid of government, getting rid of more government once you've done that. And if you want to learn more about the Libertarian Party platform, if you don't trust my view of it, just go to lp.org, take a look at the platform, see what we're really about. And this is what hundreds of delegates have debated and analyzed and drawn from so many great sources. It's an amazing resource for libertarian thought. Right now, you're listening to Libertarians Working for You. I'm your host, Arvind Vora. We'll be right back.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in your brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
Are you a pet parent? If so, you'll want to stay up to date on the latest tech gadgets and advances for your canine or feline friend. With a ton of apps, websites, tech toys, and more, you'll want to be in the know when it comes to the real treasures and the duds. For that information, listen for Pet Lover Geek with host Lorian Clemens. We test and discuss what's hot and what's not on the pet front, so you'll be better informed. Tune in Saturdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety.
I'm busy and so is my family. Leftover pizza and unhealthy takeout isn't really doing it for us anymore. Just ask my bathroom scale. That all changed when I found Freshly. For less than $10 a meal, Freshly delivers 6 meals a week, always fresh, never frozen, prepared by top chefs and nutritionists using the best, freshest, gluten-free ingredients. The best part is the menu is always new and fresh, just like the food, and it only takes 3 minutes for me to prepare breakfast, lunch, or dinner, and there's no messy cleanup and no dishes. My family loves the choices and the taste, and Freshly delivers to my home and my office, so I eat healthy all day, every day. If you're tired of the same old cardboard delivery and takeout, try out Freshly.com today and save $20 on your first order using coupon code VAH639 at Freshly.com. Your taste buds and your scale will thank you. So save $20 today with coupon code VAH639 at Freshly.com.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
This is Libertarians Working for You. If you wish to connect with our show, please call 1-866-472-5788. That number again is 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to comments@lp.org. Here again is Arvind Vora.
welcome back to Libertarians Working for You. Let's take a look at a few more questions. There's so many good ones coming in. Dan asks, is insulting Tom Woods and the Mises Institute an effective way to attract people to the party? And given the nature of the question, I assume that he's looking for an answer of no, that is not a good way. Now, I mean, I've never insulted Tom Woods. I mean, I got banned from his radio show once for some of the content in my book, about college admissions. But I don't know that I've ever insulted him. I have, however, certainly taken to task Jeff Deist, who is the head of the Mises Institute. And I took him to task, or I publicly disagreed with his views most vociferously, you could say, because he was using white nationalist catchphrases in his speech. And then when asked about it, he continued to refuse to denounce or reject white nationalism. As far as I know, he still has continued to do so. And in my own wanderings in the world of social media, I've seen more positivity towards the Mises Institute than I would honestly prefer to see. When people like that seem to be supporting the people that you think are smart, then you have to start to think what's going on over here. Racial nationalism doesn't work. That is all there is to it. It doesn't work. It turns places into cultural backwaters. It did that with Japan 200 years ago. If you look at Nobel Prizes, people talk about how Israel is this ideal situation of a racially nationalist place. First of all, it's not. I mean, yes, it's trying to be a Jewish state, but even there you have Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews that look different at the very least and certainly have many other differences. So first of all, it's not. And second of all, if you want to see where all those Jewish Nobel Prizes are coming from, they're mostly outside of Israel. Because an obsession with, in my view, an obsession with cultural or racial nationalism is basically creating for yourself a psychological and intellectual safe space, i.e. a place in which to not think. If you only are going to surround yourself with people that have the exact same background and views as you, they're not going to challenge you. And if you're not being challenged, you're going to not think. And we've seen the results from the libertarian view or from some of these folks look like they're coming a little bit more from the conservative type view, that's fine. We can see what safe space culture has done to college intellectual life. It has damaged it. If instead of discussing things, confronting disagreements, you basically just yell at somebody until they shut up, you're not facing their intellectual challenges. And that doesn't lead to intellectual growth. It leads to a laughingstock. In America, the cities that are the most innovative are also the most diverse for two reasons. One is different cultures have different skills often. You know, somebody that comes from one country, they might have a lot of expertise in one style of thinking or one particular task, and somebody from a different country, and you bring that together and you have multiple different things working together. But it also comes because ideas are challenged that way. Bad ideas stay until they get challenged by better ideas. And if no one's allowed to challenge any ideas, then you just are left with the old bad ideas. That's what happened to Japan. Japan didn't even have bad ideas. It had good ideas. It was a very effective military. Then they closed themselves off. They still remained dedicated to the military, but guess what they didn't have? Challenges. Cultural challenges, idea challenges. And so they remained stagnant. And 200 years of that stagnancy turned their military into a laughingstock. So in terms of if the question is do I think that just generally trying to insult the Mises Institute is a good overall strategy? No, probably not. I mean, I don't think that's the most effective form of outreach. I think that most of the people who know what the Mises Institute is are already know what the Libertarian Party is. But the deeper question is, do I think that if somebody tries to bring in a backwards political ideology, should we turn our heads the other way and not see that, not recognize what's happening? Or should we be very aggressive and very clear that we have no patience with that? Well, yeah, I do think that. I do think we should reject certain things. Ideas that have been proven wrong. It's not a new idea. I mean, if it's a new idea, if racial nationalism was a new idea, then I'd want to think about it and study it and all this kind of stuff. And to be fair, I have. I've looked into it and tried to see, you know, where they're coming from. But these are just rehashes of old ideas that have been proven wrong, old ideas that have failed in the marketplace of ideas, old ideas that have failed economically. They're bad ideas. It's my same view of socialism. It is a bad idea. And one of the reasons that I oppose nationalism and socialism is because I've seen what these groups do. At first, they're saying, listen, we don't want to have the state involved. We're going to be able to do this without the state. We're going to be able to have racial nationalism succeed without the state. We're going to have socialism succeed without the state. And so someone like me, whose primary first commandment is don't let the state get involved in anything ever, no matter what, I'll say, oh, okay, that sounds reasonable. And at that level, it is, yeah, fine, it's reasonable. But here's the thing. Historically, when people have bad ideas, they don't just stop when their ideas fail in the free market of ideas. Instead, once those ideas fail, they try to take over the state and use force. People have been allowed to set up communes for just 10,000 years. I mean, there's never been any significant law against setting up a commune anywhere. There have been religious communes for centuries. And nobody's going around trying to shut down monasteries, except for in religious wars, but it's not an economic reason. Nobody's going around being like, look at this religious commune, let's shut it down. People have been able to do communism, pure communism, for thousands of years, maybe all of human history. But those things didn't really succeed in the free market. Because it's just, honestly, it works for some people. If your goal is to have a vow of poverty, then yeah, communism is a good way to get poverty. But it's not a good way to get, you know, not poverty. And when that idea was shown to not be able to actually lead to prosperity, what did communists do? They turned to state force. They were saying, well, maybe if we use a state to force this on everybody, then we'll show how good an idea it is. Good ideas don't require force, but here's the fact. Bad ideas do require force. And people with bad ideas invariably turn to force. And maybe that's more of a strategic decision than a political decision, but when I see somebody with a bad idea that is historically always turned to government force, I tend to say something about it because I've seen what happens down the line. Now, let's see what other questions we have coming in over here. The next question is following off a previous question, which is why won't the LP denounce people touting ethnic cleansing and racism? I mean, I'm not sure how much more we could have denounced it. I mean, we see all these other folks that are so angry at us for denouncing it. So many people are angry at Nick Starwick, the chair of the Libertarian Party, and myself, for denouncing white nationalism, for denouncing racism, both on social media and through a formal press release. I mean, I think that we pretty strongly denounce it already, but if we need more denouncing, I re-denounce it right now. Let's look over here at... okay, Gene asks, in a hurricane situation, it's all hands on deck. In a libertarian society, no state is there to enforce standard rules on housing and safety, etc. What would happen in a natural disaster? Talking about Hurricane Harvey, what would happen in a natural disaster in the libertarian worldview? What would happen? Well, let's think about it. Let's see. What happens today when there's a personal disaster? If your house catches on fire, what happens? A lot of people say, well, the state puts the fire out. Honestly, there's more private fire departments than a lot of people realize, first of all. But also, a department that could be run by the state, if you're in a place with a public fire department, that can be run privately too. How does it work? You pay a yearly fee, for fire protection. If you choose not to pay that yearly fee, then you don't get fire protection. It's just that simple. Most people probably going to pay the yearly fee. Now today, suppose the fire department tries, but they can't put the fire out and your house burns down. What happens then? Your private insurance covers it. What happens if there is a disaster? A big disaster, not just one house fire, but a big disaster. You're going to see a couple things. One, you're going to see, you know, if there are going to be certain things that are going to be covered by insurances. And there are going to be some things that are not covered by insurances. That's true. And what's going to happen then? My guess, the same thing that happened now. You'll see lines of people rushing to volunteer to help. That's what we saw with Harvey, right? Lines of people waiting to get in to help. Those lines were gigantic. It looked like the line to some nightclub that was having an opening night and giving everybody free iPads or something. That's the human spirit. That even with all this statism, even with all this force, you can't crush that human spirit. What would you do if you saw somebody struggling for life? You'd probably do something, right? So if there was a natural disaster in a libertarian world with absolutely no government, what would happen? People would come to the rescue the way that they always, always historically have throughout all of American history. Honestly, it's probably throughout all of human history. I can't think of a time when that didn't happen. And that's the greatness of libertarian philosophy, is that it recognizes the greatness of individuals. We recognize. We don't pretend that everybody is just some, you know, selfish person who has no goal other than to hurt people. Yeah, sometimes people get twisted like that. When they're abused, often by the state, that can happen. Or when they're abused by a person. Not every crime in the world is done by the state. Many are not. But the fundamental nature of people is to be helpful. It is to provide something good. It's what we want to do. You yourself have always been proudest when you've done something good, not when you've done something, you know, silly or selfish or petty. Now, if you want to learn more about the Libertarian Party, please go to lp.org, get involved with an existing campaign, run for office yourself. Right now, you're listening to Libertarians Working for You. I'm your host, Arvind Vora. We'll be right back.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
Are you or someone you know interested in attending college? With both college tuition and college enrollment up 60% since 2002, there is a lot of competition, and careful planning needs to be a part of the process. Tune in to Getting In, a College Coach Conversation, hosted by Elizabeth Heaton and featuring a team of college coach experts. We'll bring you the tips, techniques, and know-how to navigate the road to college and do so the smart way. Listen live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Follow us on Twitter at Voice America TRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's Voice America TRN.
This is Libertarians Working for You. If you wish to connect with our show, please call 1-866-472-5788. That number again is 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to comments@lp.org. Here again is Arvind Vora.
Welcome back to Libertarians Working for You. One of the most important skills, one of the most important economic skills that humans have developed is developing currency. And it's something that we all have done for just in all kinds of circumstances. Even when you take away currency, even when you take away dollars, people find some alternative way to use currency. The the Hollywood example of people using cigarettes as currency in prison is one of many such examples. Now, right now, people have been talking about cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and all of these currencies. And many people are wondering, could Bitcoin be the way that we end the Federal Reserve? Because right now, currency is being controlled by the Federal Reserve. Why is it bad? Why does it matter if the currency is controlled by the Federal Reserve? Well, there's a moral argument that we should all be allowed to use whatever we want to as currency, right? I mean, who's somebody else to say that if I want to start using gold coins and somebody else is ready to let me buy things in gold coins, whose business is that but mine? It's no one else's business. So there's a strong moral argument. But it's not just a technical moral argument, see. It's something much bigger than that. That's the thing about this. It's a bigger thing. Today, for much of human history and today, governments have degraded the value of their currency constantly. In the past, it would be done in the following way. When the government wanted to buy something, they would just print more currency. And they would use that currency that they printed to buy whatever they wanted. And when that would happen, of course, the value of currency would constantly go down. Now, today, the U.S. government doesn't do that. It just does that once removed, right? It puts an extra step in there so that people have a harder time understanding what's happening. So I want to talk about that today. What is it that actually happens? The government doesn't just print money and spend it. They do something different. Here's what they do. There's only two steps to it. So it's not, I know a lot of you guys are like, oh my God, let me turn this off. I don't want to listen to economics. It's only two steps. The first step is that they issue debt. That means they print a savings bond, and they buy a thing. So they sell a savings bond, let's say $1,000 saving bond to somebody, right? That somebody gives them $1,000, they use $1,000 to, you know, put somebody in a rape camp or whatever it is that they're doing lately. Then what happens? Who's the most likely person to buy that savings bond? The Federal Reserve. In other words, they print the savings bond. They sell the savings bond to the Federal Reserve, who gives them the cash. And you're probably saying, wait, how is that in any significant way different from just printing the cash and spending it? And the answer is it's not. It's exactly the same thing. The result of this is obviously that the value of money constantly goes down, right? Think of it like this. 100 years ago, $20 would buy you a very nice suit. It's not going to buy you a nice suit today. On the other hand, if you look at a commodity like gold, when gold was $20 an ounce, $20 would buy you an ounce of gold, it would buy you a nice suit. Now today, gold is well over that, and so an ounce of gold will still buy you a suit. So we see that it's a much more stable type currency. Who does this affect the most? This primarily affects people who have savings. If you have savings, this is constantly degrading your savings. Who are the most likely people to have savings? Well, old people who've had their life to save. They know that they need to save because they might not be able to work as hard when they're 85 years old as they could when they were 25 years old. So what we see here is just robbing savings, primarily of the elderly, though not entirely. Anybody who has any savings that are in dollars is going to be getting robbed. And this has the following impacts. The first impact is it now makes more elderly people dependent on Social Security, creating more fans for the government. Without the government degrading the value of their savings, they wouldn't need Social Security. Why? Because they have the savings, right? But with the government degrading the value, now they need Social Security. And it's a whole huge voting bloc that's now going to keep voting for Social Security. Why? Because they need to. But why do they need to? The government destroyed their savings. The government took their savings, not by reaching to their bank account, but by printing money and spending it on idiocy. If the government stopped doing that, even today, that process would reverse and their savings would increase. Or the purchasing power of those savings would increase. Now, the other thing that it does is it enables the government to buy nonsense without a congressional fight. All that debt borrowing, that's the government spending money on nonsense without having to go through the fight of a tax. It's still a tax. They're taking the value of your money. So it's not that the tax isn't there. But the fight is gone. It's taxation without fight. In other words, it's taxation without any meaningful representation because we can't fight it as easily. It's taxation minus the huge battle that goes with a tax increase. Now, here's why Bitcoin is good, or its competitors. I mean, if you know, the good thing is, you know, the best thing about Bitcoin is, in my opinion, Litecoin or Ethereum. The fact that it has competitors is what makes it good. Bitcoin might fail one day. Who cares? It has 50,000 competitors. That's fine. And if all of cryptocurrency fails, we'll find something else. The idea is we want to create competition for the Federal Reserve so that we can be freed from having to use a currency that the government constantly messes with. If we could be freed of that, think about the benefits there. Our savings would be real. The government couldn't use your money for wars and locking people up. You couldn't have your money stolen. The nice thing about Bitcoin is it's very secure. It's very hard to tax unless you just let it be taxed. It's hard to tax Bitcoin. And people are working to make it more and more and more secure. Imagine if through this use we could not only could we end the Fed through competition, but imagine if we could start to defund all these government programs. Defund every single one of them. We won't have to worry about immigration anymore, right? Because there'd be no welfare. Somebody's coming over here to not get welfare. Why would you care? What difference does it make? If they're not getting public schools, who cares? It's not a cost. It's just somebody coming over here to do some work. And when they do work, they have money. That means they want to spend it. They might spend it on your business. That gives work to you. I know that there's this bizarre argument that when you have more people, the number of jobs decreases. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. It's not that employment, now that the United States has 300 million people, it's not that our employment rate is much lower. It's not like 20 times lower than it was when we had 3 million people. More people does not mean less employment. I know there's a lot of folks out there who are spreading that, but that just doesn't make any sense. If you have 20,000 farmers, for example, as opposed to 2,000, then there's also going to be 10 times the amount of demand for clothing, for food, for tools, for every single thing that farmers need. When you have more people, yes, you have more competition, but you also have more demand. That's how economies work. Otherwise, the way that every economy would work is whichever country was the smallest, had the fewest people, would also have the highest employment rates. And we know that that's not true, but that doesn't even make any sense. So don't let people scare you with this just made up fake Common Core style math. There's no logic in the world that suggests that having more people means that there's less employment. The Trump's rejection of the DACA is just a perfect example of that. And that's something that has no place in either libertarian philosophy or in anything that makes economic sense. Why would you take somebody who's been trained in the American way of life, who has skills, who speaks fluent English, who's a valuable person that we've spent so much time training and putting through government schooling? We've already paid. We have already paid. Why would you kick him out now? That doesn't make any sense. I mean, that's lunacy. It's like painting a car and then setting it on fire. I don't know what to say about something like that. More people is not less employment. You get less employment when you have more people who don't want to do anything. And sometimes the best way to get people to do something is to add a little competition. Thanks, guys, so much for listening today. If you want to learn more about the Libertarian Party and the Libertarian Movement, please go to lp.org. I'm your host, Arvind Vora, signing off until next week on Libertarians Working for You.
Thank you for tuning in to Libertarians Working for You. Please join Arvind Vora again next Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We hope you have a great week.